Oh, very poor. And they looked at John Grady for a decision on this question, and he told them that in spite of appearances, he was indeed very poor, and that the horse had been given to him by the grandmother herself. At this, some of them drew in their breath and shook their heads. The girl said that he needed to find some wise man with whom he could discuss his difficulties, or perhaps a curandera, and the younger girl said that he should pray to God. It was late night and dark when he rode into Torreón. He halted the horse and tied it in front of a hotel and went in and asked about a livery stable, but the clerk knew nothing of such things. He looked out the front window at the horse and he looked at John Grady.
¿Puede dejarlo atrás? He said.
¿Atrás?
Sí, afuera.
He gestured toward the rear. John Grady looked toward the rear of the building.
¿Por dónde? He said.
The clerk shrugged. He passed the flat of his hand past the desk toward the hallway.
Por aquí.
There was an old man sitting in a sofa in the lobby who'd been watching out the window, and he turned to John Grady and told him that it was all right, and that far worse things than horses had passed through that hotel lobby. And John Grady looked at the clerk and then went out and untied the horse and led it in. The clerk had preceded him down the hallway, and he opened the rear doors and stood while John Grady led the horse out into the yard. He'd bought a small sack of grain in Jahualilo, and he watered the horse in a wash trough and broke open the grain sack and poured the grain out into the upturned lid of a trash can, and he unsaddled the horse and wet the empty sack and rubbed the horse down with it, and then carried the saddle in and got his key and went up to bed. When he woke, it was noon. He'd slept almost 12 hours. He rose and went to the window and looked out. The window gave onto the little yard behind the hotel, and the horse was patiently walking the enclosure with 3 children astride it, and another leading it, and yet another hanging onto its tail. He stood in line most of the morning at the telephone exchange, waiting for his turn at one of the 4 cabinets, and when he finally got his call through, she could not be reached. He signed up again at the counter, and the girl behind the glass read his face and told him that he would have better luck in the afternoon. And he did. A woman answered the phone and sent someone to get her. He waited. When she came to the phone, she said that she knew it would be him.
"I have to see you," he said.
"I can't."
"You have to. I'm coming down there."
"No, you can't."
"I'm leaving in the morning. I'm in Torreón."
"Did you talk to my aunt?"
"Yes."
She was quiet. Then she said,
"I can't see you."
"Yes, you can."
"I won't be here. I go to La Purisima in 2 days.
"I'll meet you at the train."
"You can't. Antonio is coming to meet me."
He closed his eyes and held the phone very tightly, and he told her that he loved her, and that she had no right to make the promise that she'd made, even if they killed him, and that he would not leave without seeing her, even if it was the last time he would see her ever. And she was quiet for a long time. And then she said that she would leave a day early, that she would say her aunt was ill, and she would leave tomorrow morning and meet him in Zacatecas. Then she hung up. He boarded the horse at a stable out beyond the barrio, south of the rail tracks, and told the patron to be wary of the horse, as he was at best half broke. And the man nodded and called to the boy, but John Grady could tell he had his own ideas about horses and would come to his own conclusions. He lugged the saddle into the saddle room and hung it up, and the boy locked the door behind him, and he walked back out to the office. He offered to pay in advance, but the proprietor dismissed him with a small wave of the hand. He walked out into the sun and down the street where he caught the bus back to town. He bought a small AWOL bag in a store, and he bought 2 new shirts and a new pair of boots, and he walked down to the train station and bought his ticket and went to a cafe and ate. He walked around to break in the boots, and then went back to the hotel. He rolled the pistol and knife and his old clothes up in the bedroll and had the clerk put the bedroll in the storage room, and he told the clerk to wake him at 6 in the morning, and then went up to bed. It was hardly even dark. It was cool and gray when he left the hotel in the morning, and by the time he got settled into the coach there were spits of rain breaking on the glass. A young boy and his sister sat in the seat opposite, and after the train pulled out, the boy asked him where he was from and where he was going. They didn't seem surprised to hear he was from Texas. When the porter came through calling breakfast, he invited them to eat with him, but the boy looked embarrassed and would not. He was embarrassed himself. He sat in the diner and ate a big plate of huevos rancheros and drank coffee and watched the gray fields pass beyond the wet glass, and in his new boots and shirt he began to feel better than he'd felt in a long time, and the weight on his heart had begun to lift. And he repeated what his father had once told him, that scared money can't win, and that a worried man can't love. The train passed through a dreadful plain grown solely with cholla, and entered a vast forest of China palm. He opened the pack of cigarettes he'd bought at the station kiosk and lit one, and laid the pack on the tablecloth, and blew smoke at the glass and at the country passing in the rain. The train pulled into Zacatecas in the late afternoon. He walked out of the station and up the street through the high portales of the old stone aqueduct and down into the town. The rain had followed them down from the north, and the narrow stone streets were wet, and the shops were closed. He walked up Hidalgo, past the cathedral, to the Plaza de Armas, and checked into the Reina Cristina Hotel. It was an old colonial hotel, and it was quiet and cool, and the stones of the lobby floor were dark and polished, and there was a macaw in a cage watching the people go in and out. In the dining room adjoining the lobby, there were people still at lunch. He got his key and went up, a porter carrying his small bag. The room was large and high-ceilinged, and there was a chenille cover on the bed and a cut-glass decanter of water on the table. The porter swept open the window drapes and went into the bathroom to see that all was in order. John Grady leaned on the window balustrade. In the courtyard below, an old man knelt among pots of red and white geraniums, singing softly a single verse from an old corrido, as he tended the flowers. He tipped the porter and put his hat on the bureau and shut the door. He stretched out on the bed and looked up at the carved vigas of the ceiling. Then he got up and got his hat and went down to the dining room to get a sandwich. He walked through the narrow, twisting streets of the town, with its ancient buildings and small, sequestered plazas. The people seemed dressed with a certain elegance. It had stopped raining, and the air was fresh. Shops had begun to open. He sat on a bench in the plaza and had his boots shined, and he looked in the shop windows, trying to find something for her. He finally bought a very plain silver necklace and paid the woman what she asked, and the woman tied it in a paper with a ribbon, and he put it in the pocket of his shirt and went back to the hotel. The train from San Luis Potosí in Mexico was due in at 8 o'clock. He was at the station at 7:30. It was almost 9 when it arrived. He waited on the platform, among others, and watched the passengers step down. When she appeared on the steps, he almost didn't recognize her. She was wearing a blue dress with a skirt almost to her ankles and a blue hat with a wide brim, and she did not look like a schoolgirl, either to him or to the other men on the platform. She carried a small leather suitcase, and the porter took it from her as she stepped down, and then handed it back to her and touched his cap. When she turned and looked at him where he was standing, he realized she had seen him from the window of the coach. As she walked toward him, her beauty seemed to him a thing altogether improbable, a presence unaccountable, in this place or in any place at all. She came toward him, and she smiled at him sadly, and she touched her fingers to the scar on his cheek and leaned and kissed it. And he kissed her and took the suitcase from her. "You are so thin," she said. He looked into those blue eyes like a man seeking some vision of the increate future of the universe. He'd hardly breath to speak at all, and he told her that she was very beautiful, and she smiled. And in her eyes was the sadness he'd first seen the night she came to his room, and he knew that while he was contained in that sadness, he was not the whole of it. "Are you all right?" she said. "Yes, I'm all right." "And Lacey?" "He's all right. He's gone home." They walked out through the small terminal, and she took his arm. "I'll get a cab," he said.
"Let's walk."
"All right." The streets were filled with people, And in the Plaza de Armas there were carpenters nailing up the scaffolding for a crepe-covered podium before the governor's palace, where in 2 days' time orators would speak on the occasion of Independence Day. He took her hand and they crossed the street to the hotel. He tried to read her heart in her hand clasp, but he knew nothing. They ate dinner in the hotel dining room. He had never been in a public place with her, and he was not prepared for the open glances from older men at nearby tables, nor for the grace with which she accepted them. He'd bought a pack of American cigarettes at the desk, and when the waiter brought the coffee, he lit one and placed it in the ashtray, and said that he had to tell her what had happened. He told her about Blevins and about the Prision Castellar, and he told her about what happened to Rawlins, and finally he told her about the Cuchillero who had fallen dead in his arms with his knife broken off in his heart. He told her everything. Then they sat in silence. When she looked up, she was crying. "Tell me," he said. "I can't. Tell me. How do I know who you are? Do I know what sort of man you are? What sort my father is? Do you drink whiskey? Do you go with whores? Does he? What are men?" "I've told you things I've never told anybody. I told you all there was to tell."
"What good is it? What good?"
"I don't know. I guess I just believe in it." They sat for a long time. Finally, she looked up at him.
"I told him that we were lovers," she said.
The chill that went through him was so cold, the room so quiet. She'd hardly more than whispered, yet he felt the silence all around him, and he could scarcely look. When he spoke, his voice was lost.
"Why?" "Because she threatened to tell him. My aunt, she told me I must stop seeing you or she would tell him."
"She wouldn't have."
"No. I don't know. I couldn't stand for her to have that power. I told him myself."
"Why?"
"I don't know, I don't know."
"Is it true you told him?"
"Yes, it's true."
He leaned back. He put both hands to his face. He looked at her again. "How did she find out?"
"I don't know. Different things, Esteban, perhaps. She heard me leave the house, heard me return."
"You didn't deny it?"
"No."
"What did your father say?"
"Nothing, he said nothing."
"Why didn't you tell me?"
"You were on the mesa. I would have, but when you returned, you were arrested."
"He had me arrested?"
"Yes."
"How could you tell him?"
"I don't know. I was so foolish. It was her arrogance. I told her I would not be blackmailed. She made me crazy."
"Do you hate her?"
"No, I don't hate her. But she tells me I must be my own person, and with every breath she tries to make me her person. I don't hate her, she can't help it, but I broke my father's heart. I broke his heart."
"He said nothing at all?"
"No."
"What did he do?"
"He got up from the table, he went to his room."
"You told him at the table?"
"Yes."
"In front of her?"
"Yes. He went to his room, and the next morning he left before daylight.
He saddled a horse and left. He took the dogs. He went up into the mountains alone.
I think he was going to kill you."
She was crying. People were looking toward their table. She lowered her eyes and sat, sobbing silently, just her shoulders moving and the tears running down her face.
"Don't cry, Alejandra. Don't cry."
She shook her head.
"I destroyed everything. I only wanted to die."
"Don't cry. I'll make it right."
"You can't," she said.
She raised her eyes and looked at him. He'd never seen despair before. He thought he had, but he had not.
"He came to the mesa. Why didn't he kill me?" "I don't know. I think he was afraid that I would take my life."
"Would you?"
"I don't know."
"I will make it right. You have to let me." She shook her head.
"You don't understand."
"What don't I understand?"
"I didn't know that he would stop loving me.
I didn't know he could. Now I know. She took a handkerchief from her purse. I'm sorry, she said. People are looking at us. It rained in the night, and the curtains kept lifting into the room. And he could hear the splash of the rain in the courtyard, and he held her, pale and naked, against him. And she cried, and she told him that she loved him, and he asked her to marry him. He told her that he could make a living, and that they could go to live in his country and make their life there, and no harm would come to them. She did not sleep. And when he woke in the dawn, she was standing at the window, wearing his shirt. "Viene la madrugada," she said. "Yes." She came to the bed and sat. "I saw you in a dream. I saw you dead in a dream." "Last night?" "No, long ago, before any of this. Hice una manda." "A promise?" "Yes." "For my life?" "Yes. They carried you through the streets of a city I'd never seen. It was dawn. The children were praying. Juraba tu madre, con más razón tu puta." He put his hand to her mouth. "Don't say that. You can't say that." She took his hand and held it in hers and touched the veins. They went out in the dawn in the city and walked in the streets. They spoke to the street sweepers and to women opening the small shops, washing the steps. They ate in a café and walked in the little paseos and callejones where old vendresses of sweets, melcochas and charamuscas, were setting out their wares on the cobbles, and he bought strawberries for her from a boy who weighed them in a small brass balance and twisted up a paper Alcatraz to pour them into. They walked in the old Jardín Independencia, where high above them stood a white stone angel with one broken wing. From her stone wrists dangled the broken chains of the manacles she wore. He counted in his heart the hours until the train would come again from the south, which, when it pulled out for Torreón, would either take her or would not take her. And he told her that if she would trust her life into his care, he would never fail her or abandon her, and that he would love her until he died, and she said that she believed him. In the forenoon, as they were returning to the hotel, she took his hand and led him across the street. "Come," she said, "I will show you something." She led him down past the cathedral wall and through the vaulted arcade into the street beyond. "What is it?" he said.
"A place."
They walked up the narrow, twisting street, past a tannery, a tinsmith shop. They entered a small plaza, and here she turned.
"My grandfather died here," she said, "my mother's father."
"Where?"
"Here, in this place, Plazuela de Guadalajarita."
"In the revolution?"
"Yes, in 1914, the 23rd of June. He was with the Zaragoza Brigade under Raúl Madero. He was 24 years old. They came down from north of the city, Cerro de Loreto, Tierra Negra. Beyond here at that time, all was campo. He died in this strange place. Esquina de la calle del Deseo y el callejón del Pensador Mexicano. There was no mother to cry, as in the corridos, nor little bird that flew, just the blood on the stones. I wanted to show you. We can go."
"Quién fue el Pensador Mexicano?"
"Un poeta. Joaquín Fernández de Lizardi. He had a life of great difficulty and died young. As for the Street of Desire, it is like the Calle de Noche Triste. They are but names for Mexico. We can go now."
When they got to the room, the maid was cleaning, and she left, and they closed the curtains and made love and slept in each other's arms. When they woke, it was evening. She came from the shower wrapped in a towel, and she sat on the bed and took his hand and looked down at him.
"I cannot do what you ask," she said. "I love you, but I cannot."
He saw very clearly how all his life led only to this moment, and all after led nowhere at all. He felt something cold and soulless enter him, like another being, and he imagined that it smiled malignly, and he had no reason to believe that it would ever leave. When she came out of the bathroom again, she was dressed, and he made her sit on the bed, and he held her hands, both of them, and talked to her. But she only shook her head, and she turned away her tear-stained face and told him that it was time to go and that she could not miss the train. They walked through the streets, and she held his hand and he carried her bag. They walked through the Alameda, above the old stone bullring, and came down the steps past the carved stone bandstand. The dry wind had come up from the south, and in the eucalyptus trees the grackles teetered and screamed. The sun was down, and a blue twilight filled the park, and the yellow gas lamps came on along the aqueduct walls and down the walkways among the trees. They stood on the platform, and she put her face against his shoulder, and he spoke to her, but she did not answer. The train came huffing in from the south and stood, steaming and shuddering, with the coach windows curving away down the track like great dominoes smoldering in the dark. And he could not but compare this arrival to that one 24 hours ago, and she touched the silver chain at her throat and turned away and bent to pick up the suitcase, and then leaned and kissed him one last time, her face all wet, and then she was gone. He watched her go as if he himself were in some dream. All along the platform, families and lovers were greeting one another. He saw a man with a little girl in his arms, and he whirled her around, and she was laughing, and when she saw his face, she stopped laughing. He did not see how he could stand there until the train pulled out, but stand he did, and when it was gone, he turned and walked back out into the street. He paid the bill at the hotel and got his things and left. He went to a bar in a side street where the raucous hybrid beer hall music of the north was blaring from an open door, and he got very drunk and got in a fight, and woke in the gray dawn on an iron bed in a green room with paper curtains at a window beyond which he could hear roosters calling. He studied his face in a clouded glass. His jaw was bruised and swollen. If he moved his head in the mirror to a certain place, he could restore some symmetry to the two sides of his face, and the pain was tolerable if he kept his mouth shut. His shirt was torn and bloody, and his bag was gone. He remembered things from the night of whose reality he was uncertain. He remembered a man in silhouette at the end of a street who stood much as Rollins had stood when last he saw him, half-turned in farewell, a coat slung loosely over one shoulder. Who'd come to ruin no man's house, no man's daughter. He saw a light over a doorway in the corrugated iron wall of a warehouse where no one came and no one went. He saw a vacant field in a city in the rain, and in the field a wooden crate, and he saw a dog emerge from the crate into the slack and sallow lamplight like a carnival dog, forlorn, and pick its way brokenly across the rubble of the lot to vanish without fanfare among the darkened buildings. When he walked out the door, he did not know where he was. A fine rain was falling. He tried to take his bearing from La Buffa, standing above the city to the west, but he was easily lost in the winding streets, and he asked a woman for the way to the Centro, and she pointed out the streets and then watched him as he went. When he reached Hidalgo, a pack of dogs was coming up the street at a high trot, and as they crossed in front of him, one of their number slipped and scrabbled on the wet stones and went down. The others turned in a snarling mass of teeth and fur, but the fallen dog struggled up before he could be set upon, and all went on as before. He walked out to the edge of the town along the highway north and put out his thumb. He had almost no money and had a long way to go. He rode all day in an old LaSalle Phaeton, with the top down, driven by a man in a white suit. He said that this was the only car of its type in all of Mexico. He said that he had traveled all over the world when he was young, and that he had studied opera in Milan and in Buenos Aires, and as they rolled through the countryside he sang arias and gestured with great vigor. By this and other conveyance he reached Torreon around noon of the following day, and went to the hotel and got his bedroll. Then he went to fetch his horse. He had not shaved nor bathed, and he had no other clothes to wear, and the hostler, when he saw him, nodded his head in sympathy and seemed unsurprised at his condition. He rode the horse out into the noon traffic, and the horse was fractious and scared, and it skittered about in the street and kicked a great dish into the side of a bus, to the delight of the passengers, who leaned out and called challenges from the safety of the windows. There was an armeria in the Calle del Goyado, and he dismounted in front of it and tied the horse to a lamp standard and went in and bought a box of 45 long Colt shells. He stopped at a tienda on the outskirts of town and bought some tortillas and some tins of beans and salsa and some cheese, and he rolled them up in his blanket and tied the bedroll on behind the saddle again and refilled the canteen and mounted up and turned the horse north. The rain had ripened all the country around, and the roadside grass was luminous and green from the runoff, and flowers were in bloom across the open country. He slept that night in a field far from any town. He built no fire. He lay listening to the horse crop the grass at his stake rope, and he listened to the wind in the emptiness, and watched stars trace the arc of the hemisphere and die in the darkness at the edge of the world. And as he lay there, the agony in his heart was like a stake. He imagined the pain of the world to be like some formless parasitic being seeking out the warmth of human souls wherein to incubate, and he thought he knew what made one liable to its visitations. What he had not known was that it was mindless and so had no way to know the limits of those souls, and what he feared was that there might be no limits. By afternoon of the day following, he was deep in the Bolson, and a day later he was entering the range country and the broken land that entabled the desert mountains to the north. The horse was not in condition for the riding he called upon it to do, and he was forced to rest it often. He rode at night that its hooves might benefit from the damp, or from what damp there was, and as he rode he saw small villages distant on the plain that glowed a faint yellow in that incoordinate dark, and he knew that the life there was unimaginable to him. 5 days later he rode at night into a small crossroads pueblo nameless to him, and he sat the horse in the crossroads, and by the light of a full moon read the names of towns burned into crate slats with a hot iron and nailed to a post. San Jerónimo, Los Pintos, La Rosita. At the bottom, a board with the arrow pointed the other way that said La Encantada. He sat a long time. He leaned and spat. He looked toward the darkness in west. The hell with it, he said. I ain't leaving my horse down here. He rode all night, and in the first gray light, with the horse badly drawn down, he walked it out upon a rise beneath which he could make out the shape of the town, the yellow windows and the old mud walls where the first lamps were lit, the narrow spires of smoke standing vertically into the windless dawn, so still the village seemed to hang by threads from the darkness. He dismounted and unrolled his plunder and opened the box of shells and put half of them in his pocket and checked the pistol that it was loaded, all 6 cylinders, and closed the cylinder gate and put the pistol into his belt and rolled his gear back up and retied the roll behind the saddle and mounted the horse again and rode into the town. There was no one in the streets. He tied the horse in front of the store and walked down to the old school and stood on the porch and looked in. He tried the door. He walked around to the rear and broke out the glass and reached in and unlocked the door latch and walked in with the pistol in his hand. He crossed the room and looked out the window at the street. Then he turned and walked back to the captain's desk. He opened the top drawer and took out the handcuffs and laid them on top of the desk. Then he sat down and put his feet up. An hour later, the maid arrived and opened the door with her key. She was startled to see him sitting there, and she stood uncertainly. Pásale, pásale, he said. Está bien. Gracias, she said. She'd have crossed the room and gone on to the rear, but that he stopped her and made her take a seat in one of the metal folding chairs against the wall. She sat very quietly. She didn't ask him anything at all. They waited. He saw the captain cross the street. He heard his boots on the boards. He came in with his coffee in one hand and the ring of keys in the other and the mail under his arm, and he stood, looking at John Grady and at the pistol he was holding with the butt resting on the desktop. "Cierra la puerta," said John Grady. The captain's eyes darted toward the door. John Grady stood. He cocked the pistol. The click of the sear and the click of the cylinder hand falling into place were sharp and clear in the morning silence. The maid put her hands over her ears and closed her eyes. The captain shut the door slowly with his elbow.
"What do you want?" he said.
"I come to get my horse."
"Your horse?"
"Yes."
"I don't have your horse."
"You better know where he's at." The captain looked at the maid. She still had her hands over her ears, but she had looked up.
"Come over here and put that stuff down," said John Grady.
He walked to the desk and put down his coffee and the mail and stood holding the keys.
"Put down the keys."
He put the keys on the desk.
"Turn around. You make bad troubles for yourself."
"I got troubles you never even heard of. Turn around." He turned around. John Grady leaned forward and unsnapped the flap of the holster he wore and took out the pistol and uncocked it and put it in his belt.
"Turn around," he said.
He turned around. He hadn't been told to put his hands up, but he'd put them up anyway. John Grady picked up the handcuffs from the desk and stuck them in his belt.
"Where do you want to put the criada?" he said.
"Mande?"
"Never mind, let's go."
He picked up the keys and came around from behind the desk and pushed the captain forward. He gestured at the woman with his chin.
"Vamonos," he said.
The back door was still open, and they walked out and down the path to the jail. John Grady unlocked the padlock and opened the door. Blinking in the pale, triangular light sat the old man as before.
"Ya estás, viejo?"
"Sí, cómo no.
Ven aquí."
He was a long time rising. He shuffled forward with one hand on the wall, and John Grady told him he was free to go. He motioned for the cleaning woman to enter, and he apologized for inconveniencing her, and she said not to give it a thought. And he closed and locked the door. When he turned, the old man was still standing there. John Grady told him to go home. The old man looked at the captain.
"No lo mire a él," said John Grady. "Te lo digo yo, ándale."
The old man seized his hand and was about to kiss it when John Grady snatched it away.
"Get the hell out of here," he said. "Don't be looking at him. Go on."
The old man hobbled off toward the gate and unlatched it and stepped out into the street and turned and shut the gate again and was gone. When he and the captain went up the street, John Grady was riding the horse with the pistols stuck in his belt and his jacket over them. His hands were handcuffed before him and the captain was leading the horse. They turned down the street to the blue house where the Charo lived, and the captain knocked at his door. A woman came to the door and looked at the captain and went back down the zaguán, and after a while the Charo came to the door and nodded and stood, picking his teeth. He looked at John Grady and he looked at the captain. Then he looked at John Grady again.
"Tenemos un problema,"
said the captain. He sucked on the toothpick. He hadn't seen the pistol in John Grady's belt, and he was having trouble understanding the captain's demeanor.
"Ven aquí," said John Grady.
"Cierra la puerta."
When the Charo looked up into the pistol barrel, John Grady could see the gears meshing in his head and everything turning and falling into place. He reached behind him and pulled the door shut. He looked up at the rider. The sun was in his eyes, and he stepped slightly to one side and looked up again.
"Quiero mi caballo," said John Grady.
He looked at the captain. The captain shrugged. He looked up at the rider again, and his eyes started to cut away to the right. And then he looked down. John Grady looked off across the Ocotillo fence, where from horseback he could see some mud sheds and the rusted tin roof of a larger building. He swung down from the horse, the handcuffs dangling from one wrist.
"Vamonos," he said.
Rollins' horse was in a mud barn in the lot behind the house. He spoke to it, and it lifted its head at his voice, and it nickered at him. He told the charro to get a bridle, and he stood holding the pistol while the charro bridled the horse, and then he took the reins from him. He asked him where the other horses were. The charro swallowed and looked at the captain. John Grady reached and got the captain by the collar and put the pistol to the captain's head, and he told the charro that if he looked at the captain again, he would shoot him. He stood looking down. John Grady told him that he had no more patience and no more time, and that the captain was a dead man anyway, but that he could still save himself. He told them that Blevins was his brother, and he'd taken a blood oath not to return to his father without the captain's head. And he said that if he failed, there were more brothers, each waiting his turn. The charro lost control of his eyes and looked at the captain anyway, and then he closed his eyes and turned away and clutched the top of his thin head with one hand. But John Grady was watching the captain, and he saw doubt cloud his face for the first time. The captain started to speak to the charro, but he pulled him around by the collar with a pistol against his head and told him that if he spoke again, he would shoot him where he stood. "Tú," he said, "¿dónde están los otros caballos?" The charro stood, looking out down the barn bay. He looked like an extra in a stage play, reciting his only lines.
"En la hacienda de Don Rafael," he said.
They rode out through the town, with the captain and the charro doubled on Rawlins' horse, bareback, and John Grady riding behind them with his hands manacled as before. He carried a spare bridle slung over one shoulder. They rode dead through the center of town. Old women out sweeping the mud street in the early morning air stood and watched them go. It was some 10 kilometers to the Hacienda So Spoken, and they reached it mid-morning, and rode through the open gate and on past the house toward the stables at the rear, attended by dogs who pranced and barked and ran before the horses. At the corral, John Grady halted and removed the cuffs and put them in his pocket, and drew the pistol from his belt. Then he dismounted and opened the gate and waved them through. He led the grullo through and closed the gate and ordered them off the horse, and gestured toward the stable with the pistol. The building was new and built of adobe brick, and had a high tin roof. The doors at the far end were closed, and the stalls were shuttered, and there was little light in the bay. He pushed the captain and the charro ahead of him at gunpoint. He could hear horses snuffing in the stalls, and he could hear pigeons cooing somewhere in the loft overhead. "Red Bow," he called. The horse nickered at him from the far end of the stable. He motioned them forward. "Vámonos," he said. As he turned, a man stepped into the doorway behind them and stood in silhouette. "¿Quién está?" he said. John Grady moved behind the charro and put the gun barrel in his ribs.
"Respondele," he said.
"Luis,"
said the charro.
"Luis?"
"Sí."
"¿Quién más?"
"Raúl, el capitán."
The man stood uncertainly. John Grady stepped behind the captain.
"Tenemos un preso," he said.
"Tenemos un preso," called the captain.
"Un ladrón,"
whispered John Grady.
"Un ladrón."
"Tenemos que ver un caballo."
"Tenemos que ver un caballo,"
said the captain.
"¿Cuál caballo?"
"El caballo americano."
The man stood. Then he stepped out of the doorway light. No one spoke.
"¿Qué pasó, hombre?"
called the man. No one answered. John Grady watched the sunlit ground beyond the stable door. He could see the shadow of the man where he stood to the side of the door. Then the shadow withdrew. He listened. He pushed the two men toward the rear of the stable.
"Vámonos,"
he said. He called his horse again and located the stall and opened the door and turned the horse out. The horse pushed his nose and forehead against John Grady's chest, and John Grady spoke to him. And he whinnied and turned and went trotting toward the sunlight in the door without bridle or halter. As they were coming back up the bay, two other horses put their heads out over the stall doors. The second one was the big bay horse of Blevins. He stopped and looked at the animal. He still had the spare bridle looped over his shoulders, and he called the charro by name and shrugged the bridle off his shoulder and handed it to him and told him to bridle the horse and bring it out. He knew that the man who'd come to the stable door had seen the two horses standing in the corral, one saddled and bridled, and the other bridled and bareback, and he reckoned he'd gone to the house for a rifle, and that he would probably be back before the charro could even get the bridle on Blevins' horse, and in all of this he was correct. When the man called from outside the stable again, he called for the captain. The captain looked at John Grady. The charro stood with the bridle in one hand and the horse's nose in the crook of his arm. "Andale," said John Grady.
"Raoul," called the man.
The charro pushed the headstall over the horse's ears and stood in the stall door holding the reins.
"Vamonos," said John Grady.
There were ropes and rope halters and other bits of tack hanging from the hitch rail in the hall, and he took a coil of rope and handed it to the charro and told him to tie one end to the bridle throat latch of Blevins' horse. He knew he didn't have to check anything that the man did, because the charro could not have brought himself to do it wrong. His own horse stood in the doorway looking back. Then it turned and looked at the man standing outside against the wall of the stable.
"¿Quién está contigo?" the man called.
John Grady took the handcuffs from his pocket and told the captain to turn around and put his hands behind him. The captain hesitated and looked toward the door. John Grady raised the pistol and cocked it.
"Bien, bien," the captain said.
John Grady snapped the cuffs onto his wrists and pushed him forward and motioned to the charro to bring the horse. Rollins' horse had appeared in the stable door and stood nuzzling Redbow. He raised his head, and he and Redbow looked at them as they came up the bay leading the other horse. At the edge of the shadow line where the light fell into the stable, John Grady took the lead rope from the charro.
"Espera aquí," he said.
"Sí."
He pushed the captain forward.
"Quiero mis caballos," he called. "Nada más."
No one answered. He dropped the lead rope and slapped the horse on the rump, and it went trotting out of the stable, holding its head to one side so as not to step on the trailing rope. Outside, it turned and nudged Rollins' horse with its forehead, and then stood looking at the man crouching against the wall. The man must have made a hazing motion at it, because it jerked its head and blinked, but it did not move. John Grady picked up the end of the rope the horse was trailing, and passed it between the captain's handcuffed arms, and stepped forward and half-hitched it to the stanchion the stable door was hung from. Then he stepped out through the door and put the barrel of the revolver between the eyes of the man crouched there. The man had been holding a rifle at his waist, and he dropped it in the dirt and held his hands up. Almost instantly, John Grady's legs were slammed from under him, and he went down. He never even heard the crack of the rifle, but Blevins' horse did, and it reared onto its hind legs above him, and sprang and hit the end of the rope and was snatched sideways and fell with a great whomp in the dust. A flock of pigeons burst flapping out of the gable end of the loft overhead into the morning sun. The other two horses went trotting, and the Grullo started to run along the fence. He held onto the pistol and tried to rise. He knew he'd been shot, and he was trying to see where the man was hidden. The other man reached to retrieve the rifle lying on the ground, but John Grady turned and threw down on him with the pistol, and then reached and got hold of the rifle and rolled over and covered the head of the horse that was down and struggling so that it would not rise. Then he raised up cautiously to look.
"No tire el caballo," called the man behind him.
He saw the man who'd shot him standing in the bed of a truck 100 feet away across the lot, with the barrel of the rifle resting on top of the cab. He pointed the pistol at him, and the man crouched down and watched him through the rear window of the cab and out through the windshield. He cocked and leveled the pistol and shot a hole in the windshield, and cocked the pistol again and spun and pointed it at the man kneeling behind him. The horse moaned under him. He could feel it breathing, slow and steady, in the pit of his stomach. The man held out his hands.
"No me mate," he said.
John Grady looked toward the truck. He could see the man's boots below the axle carrier where he stood at the rear of the vehicle, and he spread himself over the horse and cocked the pistol and fired at them. The man stepped behind the rear wheel, and he fired again and hit a tire. The man ran from behind the truck across the open ground toward a shed. The tire was whistling with a single long, steady note in the morning silence, and the truck had begun to settle at one corner. Redbow and Junior stood trembling in the shadow of the stable wall, with their legs slightly spread and their eyes rolling. John Grady lay covering the horse and held the pistol on the man behind him and called to the charro. The charro didn't answer, and he called to him again and told him to bring a saddle and bridle for the other horse and to bring a rope, or he would kill the patron. Then they all waited. In a few minutes, the charro came to the door. He called out his own name before him like a talisman against harm.
"Pásale," called John Grady. "Nadie le va a molestar."
He talked to Redbow while the charro saddled and bridled him. Blevins' horse was breathing with slow regularity, and his stomach was warm, and his shirt damp from the horse's breath. He found he was breathing in rhythm with the horse, as if some part of the horse were within him, breathing. And then he descended into some deeper collusion for which he had not even a name. He looked down at his leg. His trousers were dark with blood, and there was blood on the ground. He felt numb and strange, but he felt no pain. The charro brought Redbow to him, saddled, and he eased himself up from the horse and looked down at it. Its eye rolled up at him, at the endless and eternal blue beyond. He stood the rifle on the ground and tried to get up. When he put his weight on the gunshot leg, a white pain went up his right side, and he sucked in all the air he could get. Blevins' horse lurched and scrambled to its feet and snatched the rope taut, and there was a cry from the barn, and the captain tottered forth, bent double, with his arms up behind him along the quivering length of rope, like something smoked out of a hole. He'd lost his hat, and his lank black hair hung down, and his face was a gray color, and he called out to them to help him. The horse, hitting the end of the rope at the first gunfire, had snatched him up, and had already dislocated his shoulder, and he was in great pain. John Grady stood and unfastened the rope from the throat-latch of the bay horse, and tied on the rope the charro had brought, and handed the rope-end off to the charro and told him to dally it to Redbow's saddle-horn and bring him the other two horses. He looked at the captain. He was sitting on the ground, bent over, slightly sideways, with his hands cuffed behind him. The second man was still kneeling a few feet away with his hands up. When John Grady looked down at him, he shook his head.
"Está loco," he said. "Tiene razón," said John Grady.
He told him to call the carabinero out from the shed, and he called to him twice, but the man would not come out. He knew he would not ride out of the compound without the man trying to stop him, and he knew he had to do something about Blevins' thunder-crazed horse. The charro stood holding the horses, and he took the rope and handed him back the reins and told him to go get the captain and to mount him on the grullo, and he leaned against the side of Blevins' horse and got his breath and looked down at his leg. When he looked at the charro, he was standing over the captain, holding the horse behind him, but the captain wasn't going anywhere. He raised the pistol and was about to shoot into the ground in front of the captain when he remembered about Blevins' horse. He looked at the kneeling man again, and then, using the rifle for a crutch, he swung under the horse's neck and picked up Redbow's bridle reins from the ground, and jammed the pistol into his belt and put his foot in the stirrup, and stood and swung his bloodied leg over into the saddle. He swung it harder than he needed, because he knew that if he failed the first time, he wouldn't be able to do it again, and he almost cried out with the pain. He unhitched the rope from the saddle horn and backed the horse to where the captain was sitting. He had the rifle under his arm, and he was watching the shed where the rifleman was holed up. He almost backed over the captain with the horse, and he didn't care if he had. He told the charro to unhitch the rope from the stable door stanchion and bring it to him. He'd already figured out that there was bad blood between the two men. When the charro brought the rope end, he told him to tie it to the captain's handcuffs, and he did so and stepped back.
"Gracias," said John Grady.
He had coiled the rope, and now he dallied it mid-rope to the horn and put the horse forward. When the captain saw his situation, he stood up.
"Momento!" he called.
John Grady rode forward, watching the shed. The captain, when he saw the slack rope running out along the ground, called out to him and began to run, his hands behind him.
"Momento!" he called.
When they rode out through the gate, the captain was riding Redbow, and he was double-armed behind him with his arm around the captain's waist. They led the Blevins horse on the rope and drove the other two horses before them. He was determined to get the four horses out of the stable yard if he died in the road, and beyond that he had not thought much. His leg was numb and bleeding and felt heavy as a sack of meal, and his boot was filling up with blood. When he passed through the gate, the charro was standing there holding his hat, and he reached down and took it from him and put it on and nodded.
"Adios," he said.
The charro nodded and stepped back. He put the horse forward and they went down the drive, him holding on to the captain and turned partly sideways with the rifle at his waist, watching back toward the corral. The charro was still at the gate but there was no sign of the other two men. The captain in the saddle before him smelled rank and sweaty. He'd partly unbuttoned the front of his tunic and had put his hand inside to sling the arm. When they passed the house, there was no one about, but by the time they reached the road, there were half a dozen women and young girls from the kitchen, all peering past the corner of the house. In the road, he got Junior and the Gruyot horse loose-herded in front of him, and with the Blevins horse on the lead rope behind, they set out back toward Encantada at a trot. He didn't know if the Gruyot horse would try and quit them or not, and he wished he had the spare saddle on Junior instead, but there was nothing to be done about it. The captain complained about his shoulder and tried to take the reins, and then he said he needed a doctor, and then he said he needed to urinate. John Grady was watching the road behind. "Go ahead," he said. "You couldn't smell much worse." It was a good 10 minutes before the riders appeared. Four of them, at a hard gallop, leaning forward, holding their rifles out to one side. John Grady let go the reins and swiveled and cocked the rifle and fired. Blevins' horse stood twisting like a circus horse, and the captain must have sawed back on Redbow's reins because he stopped dead in the middle of the road, and John Grady fell against him and almost pushed him forward out of the saddle. Behind him, the riders were pulling up their mounts and milling in the road, and he levered a fresh round into the rifle and fired again. And by now, Redbow had turned in the road to face the pull of the rope, and the Blevins' horse was wholly out of control. And he swung around and whacked the captain's arm with the barrel of the rifle to make him drop the reins, and he took the reins up and hauled Redbow around and whacked him with a rifle and looked back again. The riders had quit the road, but he saw the last horse disappear into the brush, and he knew which side they'd taken. He leaned down and got hold of the rope, and drew the wall-eyed horse to him, and coiled the rope and snubbed the horse up short, and whacked Redbow again, and trotting side by side, they overtook the two horses in the road before them and herded them off into the brush and out onto the rolling country west of the town. The captain half turned to him with some new complaint, but he only hugged his loathsome charge more fondly, the captain tottering woodenly in the saddle before him with his pain like a store dummy carried off for a prank. They rode down into a broad, flat arroyo, and he put the horses into a lope, his leg throbbing horribly, and the captain crying out to be left. The arroyo bore east by the sun, and they followed it for a good distance until it began to narrow and grow rocky, and the loose horses before him to step cautiously and look toward the slopes above them. He hazed them on, and they clambered up through trap rock fallen from the rim country above, and they led up onto the north-facing slope and along a barren gravel ridge, where he gripped the captain anew and looked back. The riders were fanned over the open country a mile below him, and he counted not four but six of them before they dropped from sight into a draw. He loosed the rope from the saddle horn in front of the captain and dallied it again with more slack. "You must owe them sons of bitches money," he said. He put the horse forward again and caught up to the other horses, standing, looking back 100 feet out along the ridge. There was no place to go up the draw and no place to hide in the open country beyond. He needed 15 minutes, and he didn't have them. He slid down and caught the Purisima horse, hobbling after it on one leg, and the horse shifting and eyeing him nervously. He unhitched the bridle reins from about the saddle horn and stood into the stirrup and pulled himself painfully onto the horse and turned and looked at the captain. "I want you to follow me," he said, "and I know what you're thinking, but if you think I can't ride you down, you better think some more. And if I have to come get you, I'm going to whip you like a dog. Me entiende?" The captain didn't answer. He managed a sardonic smile, and John Grady nodded. "You just keep smiling. When I die, you die." He turned the horse and rode back down into the arroyo. The captain followed. At the rock slide, he dismounted and tied the horse and took out a cigarette and lit it and hobbled up around the tumbled rocks and boulders carrying the rifle. In the sheltered lee of the slide, he stopped and took the captain's pistol out of his belt and laid it on the ground, and he took out his knife and cut a long, narrow strip from his shirt and twisted it into a string. Then he cut the string in two and tied the trigger back on the pistol. He wrapped it tightly so as to depress the grip safety, and he broke off a dead limb and tied the other string to it and tied the free end to the hammer of the pistol. He put a good-sized rock on top of the stick to hold it, and he stretched the pistol out until the string cocked the hammer, and then laid the pistol down and rolled a rock over it, and when he slowly released it, it held. He took a good draw on the cigarette to get it burning, and then laid it carefully across the string, and stepped back and picked up the rifle and turned and hobbled back out to where the horses stood. He took the water bottles, and he slid the bridle down off the Gruyot's head and caught it, and he stroked the Gruyot under the jaw. "I hate to leave you, old partner," he said. "You've been a good one." He handed the water bottles up to the captain and slung the bridle over his shoulder, and reached a hand up, and the captain looked down at him, and then reached down with his good hand, and he struggled up onto the horse behind the captain, and reached around and took the reins, and turned the horse back up the ridge again. He caught up the loose horses and drove them down off the ridge and out across the open country. The ground was volcanic gravel and not easy to track a horse over, but not impossible either. He pushed the horses hard. There was a low rocky mesa 2 miles across the floodplain, and he could see trees and the promise of broken country. Not halfway across, he heard the dead flat pop of the pistol he'd been listening for. "Captain," he said, "you just fired a shot for the common man." The trees he'd seen from the distance were the breaks of a dry river course, and he pushed the horses through the brush and entered a stand of cottonwoods and turned the horse and sat watching back across the plain they'd traversed. There were no riders in sight. He looked at the sun in the south, and he judged it a good 4 hours till dark. The horse was hot and lathered, and he looked back across the open country one more time, and then pushed on to where the other two horses were standing upriver in a grove of willows, drinking from a riverbed pothole. He rode alongside them and slid to the ground and caught Junior and took the bridle from his shoulder and bridled him with it, and with the rifle motioned the captain down off the horse. He unbuckled the girth straps and pulled the saddle and the blanket down onto the ground and picked up the blanket and threw it over Junior and leaned against him to get his breath. His leg was beginning to hurt horribly. He stood the rifle against the actual horse and picked up the saddle and managed to get it on, and he pulled the girth strap and rested, and he and the horse blew, and then he pulled the strap again and cinched it. He picked up the rifle and turned to the captain. "You want a drink of water, you better get you one," he said. The captain walked up past the horses, holding his arm, and he knelt and drank and laved water over the back of his neck with his good hand. When he rose, he looked very serious. "Why you no leave me here?" he said.
"I ain't leaving you here. You're a hostage."
"Mande?"
"Let's go."
The captain stood uncertainly.
"Why'd you come back?" he said.
"Come back for my horse. Let's go."
The captain nodded at the wound in his leg, still bleeding, the whole trouser leg dark with blood.
"You're going to die," he said.
"We'll let God decide about that. Let's go."
"Are you no afraid of God?"
"I got no reason to be afraid of God. I even got a bone or two to pick with him."
"You should be afraid of God," the captain said. "You're not the officer of the law. You don't have no authority."
John Grady stood leaning on the rifle. He turned and spat dryly and eyed the captain.
"Get on that horse," he said. "You ride ahead of me. You drift out of my sight, and I'll shoot you."
Nightfall found them in the foothills of the Sierra Encantada. They followed a dry watercourse up under a dark rincón in the rocks, and picked their way over a flood barricade of boulders tumbled in the floor of the wash, and emerged upon a stone tinaja, in the center of which lay a shallow basin of water, perfectly round, perfectly black, where the night stars were lensed in perfect stillness. The loose horses walked uncertainly down the shallow rock incline of the basin, and blew at the water and drank. They dismounted and walked around to the far side of the tinaja and lay on their bellies on the rocks where the day's heat was still rising and sucked at the water cool and soft and black as velvet, and they laved water over their faces and the backs of their necks and watched the horses drink and then drank again. He left the captain at the tank and hobbled with the rifle up the arroyo and gathered dead flood-wash brush and hobbled back and made a fire at the upper end of the basin. He fanned the blaze with his hat and piled on more wood. The horses and